This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Walk into a wine shop today, and you'll likely find hundreds of brands and vintages, but most will be made from a handful of grape varieties grown in a handful of wine-making hotspots. Think Pinot Noir from France, Chianti from Italy, Chardonnay from California. That's ostensibly because those are the best wine grapes and the best places to grow them. But in fact, wine has been grown and made in a huge range of places for thousands of years, and there's an emerging movement to preserve and recover local grape varieties and winemaking traditions that have been lost or even stamped out over the past few centuries. Kevin Bagos explores the twisting evolution of grapes and wine in his new book, Tasting the Past: The Science of Flavor and the Search for the Origins of Wine. It's out this week. Kevin, welcome to Living Lab Radio.
Thank you, Heather. Great to be on with you.
There are many varieties of grapes. I've got Concord grapes in my backyard, but they're not going to make very good wine. What makes a wine grape suitable for winemaking?
You know, I learned during this book that people have been tweaking grapes for about 8,000 years. Wild grapes had hardly any fruit on them. They just had big pits and a tiny little bit of fruit around them, and probably didn't taste very good. But people started domesticating them and immediately started picking out the bigger, fatter berries and the sweeter berries and the better tasting berries. And that's been kind of going on for a good 6,000 or 8,000 years. And the grapes respond by, seemingly respond by rewarding that.
They reward us with that, the wine that we love so much. Do we know what gives them all of those different flavors? Why, Cabernet tastes different than Merlot? Is it just about where they're grown, or are there inherent differences between the grapes?
There are inherent differences, and actually the genetics of the grapes, they actually have more genes that produce flavor and aroma compounds than the grapes split off from poplars and other ancient plants probably 150 million years ago, 100 million years ago. So if you compare the genome of grapes and rice, there are actually big differences in the number of genes that can, in the end, express flavors.
And do we know what those genes do to create flavors?
That's where it gets really complicated, because they're starting to identify particular ones. Like, scientists have found the particular gene that gives Syrah a spicy, peppery flavor. The compound, I should say. But it's like a lot of other things with genetics and anything. What turns them on and off and what makes the difference between a good wine and a great wine, that is a combination of where it's grown and the winemaker. And what really surprised me is the yeast contribute to flavors too. You know, everybody always, I think, knows that yeast make the alcohol, the fermentation. But it turns out the yeast contribute to flavors, different native varieties of yeast in different regions.
Fascinating. So it's not just about the variety of grapes, it's about the variety of yeast and how the two work together.
Yeah, I kind of began to think of the yeast as like the bass player in a rock band. They don't get they're absolutely vital, but they don't get all the press, and they're not at the front of the stage, but they're really important.
If we just stick with the grapes, how many different varieties of wine grapes are there? I mean, we could all probably rattle off, half a dozen or a dozen, but there's got to be more than that.
There's at least 1,400. Not all of those are used in large quantities. Some are almost extinct. And, Concord can, the grape in your backyard was used by Americans to make wine at certain times, but it's not really considered a wine grape. But there are hundreds and hundreds of local varieties throughout Italy, France, and especially the Caucasus Mountains, where winemaking originated, Armenia and Georgia and eastern Turkey.
And why are we down then with all of this variety to just a handful that are used to make the vast majority of wine?
Well, the blunt reaction was from Andy Walker, a great grape scientist at the University of California at Davis, and he summed it up as, quote, a marketing scam. Mm. I basically agree with him, but, up until World War II, or actually before World War I, there were native grapes all over the world. Regions grew their own grapes. But after World War II, Americans started drinking more wine. The California wine regions took off, and Americans weren't really familiar with wine. And since we didn't have native grapes, the first big California successful wineries started to put Chardonnay and Merlot and Cabernet on the labels. And American consumers especially, plus Australian and people in Chile and other places, you know, start to look for those certain names as being the equivalent of great wine. And sometimes they are, but it's not just those grapes that make great wine.
Well, it goes back even farther than World War II, though. I mean, we've had in Europe the idea of the noble grapes for a lot longer than a few decades.
Yeah, it really changed probably in the late 1800s when they got wiped out by phylloxera, a little pest that, you know, destroyed their vineyards. Before that time, they did have more diversity. And then after their vineyards were wiped out and they replanted, they started replanting more and more with those. But even in France, southern France and western France always had some different grapes, Tannat and things like that, that were more regional. But you're right, noble grapes, that concept goes back to at least Shakespeare, although he kind of made a little fun of it.
You've already mentioned how our understanding of grape genetics is starting to change our understanding of flavor. It's also really changing our understanding of all of these varieties and the evolution and diversity of grapes. And you tell one great story in the book about how it turns out that these noble grape varieties are actually all descended from what was thought to be kind of a trash grape.
Yes, some of the Chardonnay and some of the others all were connected to Gouais, which was, there's an even stronger term that was used in the vernacular a couple hundred years ago for Gouais. It was literally banned in some areas of France and Europe. But it's one of the parents. And, you know, when you think about it, it's just the same as everything else. I mean, we all know that two people can have a child that's great at math, even though, you know, the parents aren't great at math or great at languages or great at music. So offspring do, you know, have special characteristics sometimes that the parents don't.
And as we've started to grow more and more of just a smaller number of grapes, are we cutting out opportunities to perhaps find or invent or discover new flavors?
Absolutely. And it's kind of even worse than that. I just had an excerpt of the book come out in Smithsonian Magazine, which people can see online if they want to look at it. And some leading grape scientists point out that by just focusing on those, it's really five or six main French grape varieties, we've actually stopped those from evolving because all the grapevines are propagated by cuttings, you know, not from seeds. So Pinot Noir, it's probably 2,000 years old since it's really crossbred with another grape. That makes them incredibly susceptible to vineyard pests and funguses and things like that, which means the vineyards have to use more and more pesticides. So not only are we limiting ourselves experiencing other flavors, the grapes are more and more inbred, the famous grapes. And don't get me wrong, there are some great wines made from those grapes, but we're like loving them to death.
I'm talking with Kevin Bagos about his book, Tasting the Past, The Science of Flavor and the Search for the Origins of Wine. You've mentioned this briefly, but when and where were grapes first domesticated? When did we go from those pretty, you know, seedy, not so flavorful grapes out in the wild to something closer to what we would recognize today?
There's definite evidence from Georgia, the Republic of Georgia, 8,000 years ago, and archaeologists found a clay container, pretty substantial, I think more than 20 gallons perhaps, and it actually had a grape, a somewhat crude but recognizable grape motif on it, and they found remains that they were able to analyze. And then there's an actual small winemaking facility found in a cave in Armenia that dates to 6,000 years ago. So around that 6,000 to 8,000 year period in the mountains there, people were definitely engaging in small scale organized winemaking. And then the Hittites, ancient cities of Babylon and things like that, and the Egyptians especially, went into massive large scale vineyards.
We don't think of that as prime winemaking or vineyard territory anymore, but you point out that the botany, the diversity of plants, and the ecology of that region is incredibly rich and kind of unique.
It really is. I'd never visited the Caucasus Mountains until a few years ago, and It's startlingly beautiful and just a real diversity of mountains and plains. And it's basically where Europe and Asia crash together, but not that far from, you know, the edge of North Africa where Egypt crashed up into the peninsula. So it's a mix of those geological and botanical zones.
And do they still make wine from local varieties there today?
Yes, Georgia has absolutely kept to their traditions. They not only make wine from their local varieties like Kisi and Riccatelli and Saporavi, but they still make them in the clay containers. They call them Quevri, but we might think of them as amphora, what you see scattered along the bottom of the Mediterranean and all those archaeological stories where they uncover an old shipwreck.
You started off on your journey looking into wine. I mean, you were a journalist, a foreign correspondent, and this all started with one mysterious wine from Bethlehem and kind of digging into the origins and the history of winemaking in the Middle East, where, again, we don't necessarily think of that as being a winemaking hotspot. Tell us a little bit about that story.
It was started by complete accident. I was in Amman, Jordan, and not expecting to find wine at all. And there was this little bottle in the minibar from Cremasan Monastery and Cellars. And that just really surprised me. I'd never heard of them. I'd never thought monks were still making wine in 2008. And when I got back to the U.S., I couldn't find the wine anywhere. There was no importers. So, you know, when there's something you want and you can't have it, you get kind of obsessed. But I kept looking and looking and eventually found out more about them and visited them years later. And it turns out there was a huge tradition of winemaking that with local grapes, Hamdani and Baladi and Jandali, that has been going on for thousands of years. But it took me a long time to figure that out. And it even took experts a long time to figure that out because they were just quietly making wine in the monastery for kind of local people to buy.
What have you learned about the maybe growing movement to try to preserve those local varieties, those local traditions, and maybe even in some cases bring back what's been lost over the past few hundred years?
I was really surprised and encouraged to see this happening in half dozen different countries and even in America. People are going back looking for what they call grapes that their grandfather or grandmother might have grown. And even going back and finding old plots in the mountains that, you know, a few of these native grapes might still exist. You know, in some cases, there's just an acre or two of them that were still growing somewhere. And people are starting to preserve them and make wine from them and often make very good wines and wines that even critics recognize as very good. So I think it's the equivalent of the slow food movement kind of finally coming to the wine world.
Kevin Bagos is author of Tasting the Past, The Science of Flavor, and The Search for the Origins of Wine. That book is out this week. Kevin, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.